Welcome to Intellectual Property Matters. In this WIPO podcast, we explore the fascinating world of creativity, innovation, and intellectual property. Let's listen, learn, and get inspired.
Hello, I'm Ben Rylan. Welcome to the first episode of Eye on Copyright Enforcement, a mini-series of the World Intellectual Property Organization's latest podcast, Intellectual Property Matters. Now, you might be wondering, why copyright enforcement? Well, every day we enjoy movies, music, books, video games, and countless apps on our phones, all thanks to the work of artists and creators from around the world. While copyright automatically protects the work of creators, fighting copycats is still a major challenge. When do we infringe copyright? What do creators and users of content need to know about respecting copyright, offline and online? And what can some landmark copyright infringement cases teach us? In conversations with artists, lawyers, and creative industry experts, we'll explore the importance of respecting copyright. Today, Todd Pipes, member of the 90s rock band Deep Blue Something, shares what he wishes he'd known about copyright when he was just starting out. Many years ago, around 2005, I think, I was driving through rural Australia in the state of Victoria. Now, this was before the time of Spotify playlists, so the only music I could listen to in my car was whatever the local radio station happened to be playing. The music in country Victoria tends to be rather pub rock inspired. Think AC/DC, Midnight Oil, or perhaps quintessentially Cold Chisel. Then, to my surprise, a song started playing that I'd completely forgotten about.
You'll say, we've got nothing in common, no common ground to start from. And we're falling apart.
It was called Breakfast at Tiffany's, and it was first released in 1995, when I was just 10. I'd grown up loving old Hollywood films, so anything that celebrated a classic movie was going to get my attention. The music video featured the band sitting down to a rather improbable champagne breakfast at a large oak dining table, on the street outside the same Tiffany's store that Audrey Hepburn was standing in front of when she took that famous bite of a pastry. Aside from the lyrics in the song, a few glimpses of the shopfront are the only nods we get to the classic film. And yet, the hit song still plunged the band into a little bit of hot water. Not because of its association to old Hollywood cinema, however. Todd Pipes is the lead singer of the band Deep Blue Something. Todd, welcome to the show and thank you for joining us. First, tell us, how did your hit track Breakfast at Tiffany's first come about?
It was a combination of things. One, I had had the phrase Breakfast at Tiffany's in my head for a long time, like a year. I knew that if I could work that into a song, there's something about the way that phrase sounds, whether you've read the book or seen the movie or anything, something about that sounds good, interesting, right? But it's not easy to work into a song. You know, there's a lot of syllables. So I had that in my head for a long time. And then on the other side of things, I was in graduate school at the time studying writing, and, you know, we were reading a lot of prose poetry at that time, or at least that semester, Baudelaire and Rambo and those guys. And so I was thinking at the same time, would it be possible to write a popular song that didn't rhyme? Okay. So I had those two different ideas. I hadn't considered putting them together. It was just these two ideas. So one day I worked at the university library, and then I had 15 minutes or so before I had to go to work. I sat down on the couch and Roman Holiday was on. Okay. Different Audrey Hepburn movie. And I thought, yeah, I just need to try to work on this song. You can walk around with it in your head forever. At some point you got to sit down with the guitar and start working on it. So I sat down and started playing this D thing. You know, this progression in D, and, you know, and I just started going, Breakfast at Tiffany's. And I was like, oh, that fits. If I go from D to the kind of a B and then this A to G thing, I can get Breakfast at Tiffany's in there. So, well, how do I what needs to come first then? And that's what made me think of, and I said, what about Breakfast at Tiffany's? And I was like, that's it. So I wrote the whole song around that, those two lines, because that got the phrase into the song. You know, she said, I think I remember the film. Okay, that's very easy. So now I've got this other character. There's a boy and a girl. This is going to be a breakup song. And then it all kind of hit me. These two people are breaking up. Their relationship was so worthless that the only thing they got out of it was that they kind of liked the same movie. They didn't like it a lot. They just kind of liked it, if they remember right. And that's it. That's the whole. And I was like, okay, cool. So I had the chorus. I had kind of the rough progression. And I walked to the library to work. And that's when I started kind of going over the lyrics. And I started just writing down the ideas about this back and forth, right? You say, we got nothing in common, blah. And that's when it hit me. Maybe this is the song I can hide the lack of rhyme idea, the prose idea into it, because the chorus will carry the song and people won't notice that none of it rhymes. And so I wrote it. I finished the lyrics at the library, took it to rehearsal right after that. And so we played it and I could tell that first time that it connected with people. But the funny thing is, no one noticed ever that it didn't rhyme. My bandmates didn't mention it. No one noticed. And I was going, well, I guess that's a good thing that no one's noticed. But I was trying to do something what I thought was impressive. And no one's noticed, like, for years and years. But there you go.
So, Todd, given the song references popular culture, were you ever at least a little bit concerned about any copyright issues?
I thought about that, but I knew from a little bit from the writing standpoint that you can reference another work, you know, and this is two characters in this poem, if you will, referencing something else. I wasn't too stressed about that. I was just reading The Love Song of Jail for Proof Rock by T.S. Eliot the other day. And he has a long introduction that's taken straight from Dante's Inferno. Like, he quotes it, you know. And again, he's making reference. He's citing the reference. He's not trying to act like it's his own, but it's there, you know. And that's done a lot in literature.
You were obviously quite a bit younger back then, just starting out in many ways. Was copyright ever on your mind in those days?
Yes, because of sampling. And it was still relatively new, because what a lot of people don't know is that Toby and I had come out of an electronic background. That we had only picked up guitars as a matter of convenience, you know, because setting up synths and samplers and drum machines and playing a live show, it's a pain. Whereas where we had gone to school, there were tons of bands and it was just grab your guitar, you grab your amp, you throw your stuff on stage and you start playing. So all that to say, we had been around kind of the early parts of using samples in songs, and we knew at the time when it first started, you could have 4 seconds of a song and use it in your own, which was crazy because you can base an entire song around 4 seconds. 4 seconds is a long time. Now, this was changed, but originally. So you take a song like Kiss Them For Me by Susie and the Banshees. Or Pearl by Chapter House. And they both use a sample of a rap song. BS King, we're making that green. People always say, what the hell does that mean? But it's the entirety, it's the basis of the rhythm of both of those songs. The songs are written around that. But that came under that 4-second loophole at the time. So we were very aware of that type of thing, you know, because that's the copyright of the recording. The copyright of the song, things get a little bit more vague because there's 100 songs that have a 1-3-5 chord progression. It's when the chord progression becomes more complex that you can point at it and say, that one was mine. Like when Radiohead had Creep, everybody was like, oh my God, they stole that whole entire song. That's it. They stole that song. That was pretty obvious to people. So we were aware of it on a sampling end, didn't really care too much about on the songwriting end. I don't know. I felt like we were fairly safe with our chord progressions and stuff.
I've heard that there are many artists who are actually terrified of accidentally infringing on copyright. Do you think it's easy to do that?
Now, for sure. And in fact, that's part of my problem with modern music. And I don't think it's, some of it is very intentional. Some of it you can tell they sat down and said, let's write this song, and they steal the entire thing. And if it's successful, well, then they just give away some of their publishing to the writer, and there no one cares, but it's outright stealing. But the problem is, even if you don't do it intentionally, well, within the format of rock and roll or pop music, there's only so many pleasing chord progressions, like the Don't Stop Believin' chord progression. That's literally, there's 100 songs. As time moves forward, it's going to become more and more difficult to have a song that's truly unique, because we are in the confines. Because if you start to change your chord progression too much, well, then it becomes very like progressive music or classical. So we're kind of stuck here. It's happened to me before too. You know, you sit down and you write something and you very quickly realize, oh my gosh, I just wrote such and such. But then there have been other times where I thought, well, I'm stealing that. And I'll see if anybody says, you know, like a small part. And then you get worried, oh my gosh, it is too much like it. And then I'll go back and listen to the original, and I won't have realized that I strayed so far from it that it's not anywhere near it.
Now, you had a bit of a brush with copyright ownership law early in your career. When someone claimed ownership of some of your early work, what happened?
We had made a record for this independent company. Okay, just a small indie label. Okay, and it had a version of Breakfast at Tiffany's on it. We had recorded it. Okay, well, there's two different types of copyright. There's a copyright of the writing of the song, and then there's copyright of the recording. We didn't think that that was that great of a version. So when we made the home album, we re-recorded Breakfast at Tiffany's and did a much better version. Okay. Well, the problem was, where the lawsuit stemmed, is that that the person on the opposite end was somewhat ignorant about the two types of copyright. Like, yes, that recording that was on your label, well, we're not using that recording. And you don't have anything in the contract that says that we can't re-record it. So we have re-recorded it. A lot of that whole lawsuit, the problem was the parties on different sides simply not understanding what they were going after. Because at one point they were going after Interscope, and Interscope was going, what you're asking, it doesn't even make sense. So if this lawsuit had been brought up, say, in LA, it would have been dismissed instantaneously because the people out there were more familiar with it. The lawsuit was filed in Denton, Texas, where the lawyer's not involved in the music business, the judge, anybody involved was just like, well, I guess we got to see what happens here because it seems like they've done this. And you're like, no, it's two different copyrights. And that eventually got settled. And much like many lawsuits, the lawyers made the most money, but whatever. So what I've also faced a couple of times are people randomly that have claimed that they co-wrote the song. Like, oh yeah, I knew Todd. I used to hang out with him all the time. I wrote Breakfast at Tiffany's. And somebody eventually will come to me and go, hey man, have you ever heard of this person? And I'm going, no, I don't know. Well, he's claiming, like, there was this one guy in Dallas who had claimed this, and he was using it to get gigs, to get producing gigs, to get, you know, gigs in bands and stuff, claiming that, yeah, I wrote that. But I just hadn't heard of it. The craziest one was I got an email from the bass player of the Spin Doctors. He was out in LA. He was a part of this kind of fun cover band side project thing that had different people from different bands, and they were doing this thing, right? One of the guys in his band, the way he got in the band is because he claimed to have written Breakfast at Tiffany's for us. And he was doing some fairly suspicious things. And so the guy, just on a hunch, contacts me. He said, hey, bass player from the Spin Doctors, here's my situation. Do you know this person? I was going, no, I've got, what are you talking about? And he explained that this guy had gotten this gig and many others out in LA, just claiming out of hand to have written Brexit Tiffany's, and just no one had checked him on it. And so I contacted him and said, I know what you're doing, and I hope you've got some deep pockets because you're going to pay for this one. And I got this long letter. I'm sorry. Yes, I absolutely did it. I used it to get gigs and it worked. So I'm not even going to try to claim that I didn't, but I don't have any money and suing me really won't do any good, but I won't do it again. Yeah, even with the internet, people just believe stuff.
Still to come, we'll hear from Todd on what he wishes he'd known when he was just starting out. Stay tuned. Todd, do you remember how difficult it was to find a song that you liked before Spotify came along?
Yeah, and YouTube too. I think YouTube is even better. And now it's just, it's the greatest thing. I spend so much time going down wormholes on YouTube. It's fantastic. Yeah, everything is out there. And now, like, yeah, because of Spotify and Tidal and all those digital services, almost every record that has ever been made is right there. If you can think of it, it's somewhere.
Now, Todd, this is actually a true story. I actually remember watching the music video for Breakfast at Tiffany's on Saturday mornings when I was a kid. And I did buy the single, but, you know, I kind of lost track of my music collections. But then one day, years later, I think it must have been around 2010, I was walking through a shopping mall in the outskirts of Melbourne when I just happened to glance at the single section of a CD shop. Now, for those born post-2000, CD singles were like CDs that contained maybe one or two tracks. And Todd, there you were, at least 10 years after the release of the single. Somehow, your CD was being sold at this shop alongside whatever the top tracks of the day were, Fallout Boy and Linkin Park, I suppose. So there you go. I actually bought your CD single twice.
Awesome. I appreciate that. Okay, so that's on the consumer end. You go to a shop and it's not there. Okay, imagine though being in a band and being on tour to promote your record and you stop by the record store and they don't have it. The frustration of distribution is unbelievable. These great bands who had made a great record, but the distribution side of their record company was bad. You know, Big Star is one that I always think of. They're unbelievable, incredibly influential. The people who bought Big Star records immediately went out and started bands of their own. But the problem was they were signed to a label that was primarily rhythm and blues based. And had no connection with rock record stores. And so no one bought their records because they couldn't. Whereas now, no matter how obscure, even if I'm not a label, if I'm just a guy and I know how to make one thing on my computer, just a drum beat that goes for 5 minutes, well, I can record it today and it can be available worldwide on Tuesday.
Now, obviously, artists today are working in a completely different world with the internet. Do you think young artists are getting more savvy to digital rights protection?
I think sadly, and maybe now more than ever, artists are not savvy to anything. I know they're you know very concerned if they're getting some upfront money so that they can kind of perpetrate a lifestyle, you know. But they don't realize, well, yeah, they may have given you some upfront money and that's fun because if you're, 19 years old and you just, made a rap record or something, well, to you, $25,000 is an insane amount of money. Look at all the money I've got. But what you haven't paid attention to is that you just signed a deal where you're getting 2%. And I try to explain this to people, like hip hop and Christian music, I think are the most nefarious. The Christian end, I think, is actually really funny. You will sign a record deal, not with a record company, but with a producer. And the producer has signed a deal with the record company. So you may be getting, the artist thinks, oh, I got a 15% deal, or I got a 20% deal. But yeah, you got a 20% deal of a 15% deal. So you're not making, and also your deal is for sales royalties, not for publishing, because the guy who made the beat, you don't know this, but that production guy signed something that says that guy owns the song or at least 50% of it because he made the beat that you're rapping over. Because hip hop, more than anything else, you're here and gone. it's old instantaneously. So somebody who's mega right now, 6 months is nothing, and they've got nothing to show for it. They're just sitting there going, what happened? The Christian end of things is very, very similar. If you write a song as a Christian songwriter, it will usually get absorbed into a conglomerate that has signed a different publishing deal. And it's the same kind of thing. And what you don't realize is you don't own any of the song. You've signed the whole thing over to somebody else, which you used to not be able to legally do, but you can now. So people are not aware, or they think they're aware, but there's 10 billion loopholes. And now the danger is you don't have the physical paper trail to follow in an audit.
With a track as successful as yours, I suppose you must go online and see it popping up in all sorts of strange marketplaces that you've got no idea about. How do you feel about unauthorized versions of your music online?
And I've noticed this, that there for a little while, it would pop up like someone doing a cover version, and they get, you know, they have like 500,000 hits on their YouTube channel. The publisher is usually paying attention to that kind of thing. And I noticed that in the last couple of years, Universal has really cracked down on those types of things. We did have something in our contract, which I asked for, and I cannot imagine why I thought to ask for it. But I had in our original Interscope contract had said, you cannot put this on a compilation without our permission. Because I guess I had read somewhere that that's how they'll get you. They'll sell, you know, 500,000 copies of a compilation, and then you don't get anything because it's promotional material. So we've been protected in some ways about that kind of thing, because we have a strong publisher, Warner Chappell, and then we have a strong Universal Music on that end of things. So, you know what I'm saying? So we don't see too much where it pops up and we're like, what the heck is this about? I have witnessed a few sound alikes, like on the background of this one particular reality construction show. They kept playing this song over and over that was Breakfast at Tiffany's. It was just plain as day. You know, it had been re-recorded. It was slightly different. Through a mutual friend, I had him contact it and just go, hey, man, if you want to use the song, just ask us. You know, we've got mutual friends. Just ask us. We'll re-record it for you. But are you kidding? You use this little clip 15 times a show. It's so obviously that's what it is. You could at least pay us. You're making millions. You know, is it not in your budget that you couldn't have just even asked?
Do you have any advice that you'd give to your younger self?
The thing that I was the most unaware, and just like everyone else, was when that first wave of people copying and sending things on the internet, we were a major victim in that. Breakfast at Tiffany's was sent, I have to think that there were millions of dollars lost in that first file sharing thing on our end. I don't know what I would have done, what I could have said to myself to have paid attention to it, but that was the thing. The record companies were naive. We had no earthly idea about that. That was astounding to me. That changed everything.
We've been talking a lot about how online marketplaces affect rights protection for, especially for younger artists. I suppose it's fair to say that piracy has sort of gone down in many ways because of the ease of the streaming age. I mean, when you think about it, you pay a small fee to be a member of something like Spotify or whatever, and that means that you have access to virtually everything. Piracy is kind of thrown in the too hard basket for a lot of people. Do you think that that's become a good thing? I mean, Spotify has basically succeeded in making piracy just too difficult.
I do. 100%. And I think it encourages seeking out and finding new things. I use Tidal because the frequencies are broader, because I do a lot of production and mastering still. So I want to hear the highest fidelity, and Tidal has higher fidelity than Spotify. I am seeking out so much more music because I don't have my wife over my shoulder going, you bought 10 albums last month on iTunes. I just got the bill. You know, it really kind of pays off for me because I'm just consuming so much music and going down all these rabbit holes. I think it is positive. Yeah, because you're right. Why would I bother trying to find somewhere to steal it for free when essentially once I've paid my monthly thing and I've consumed 5 albums worth of material, well, then this is free, essentially. You know, so I think it's there. If they could just make a couple of tweaks to make it slightly more friendly for the artist, I think in the long run, it's going to be great.
Todd Pipes, thank you very much for joining us. And thank you for listening to Eye on Copyright Enforcement, a production of the World Intellectual Property Organization, brought to you with the support of the Ministry of Culture, Sports and Tourism of the Republic of Korea. I'm Ben Rylan. I'll be back next time with another conversation on copyright enforcement. I do hope you'll join me. Until then, goodbye.